It's a gift to be able to convince yourself of something and believe it with all your heart. You are doing this for power, the same as all of us.
Greed, power, corruption, and the stench of dirty money. Today's podcast shines a light on the murky world of criminal finance. We ask, is it all hopeless? An all-consuming monster of our times, or can Europe do something about it? Welcome to Saving Europe from Itself with me, Zoe Williams from The Guardian, and my co-host, Luke Cooper from the LSE. On this special series of podcasts from the Another Europe team, we take one big idea from one big thinker and put it through its paces. On this podcast, we look at how we can tackle dark money, the numerous connections between our global financial system and the world of organised crime and corruption. We're joined by Oliver Bulow, author of Moneyland, Why Thieves and Crooks Now Rule the World and How to Take It Back, and a regular contributor to Guardian Long Reads. His idea, turn the EU on the crooks.
When we think about money laundering, we usually think of HSBC in Mexico, with its suitcases full of cash, its cashier's windows just the right size for those suitcases to fit through, and its determination to help drug cartels slip their dirty cash into the global financial system. But that was an analog crime, and we're in a digital age, when no suitcase in the world could fit the volumes of money being moved. Just look at the Danske Bank scandal as exposed last year. In 2007-15, the Estonian branch of Denmark's biggest bank moved 200 billion euros of suspicious money out of the ex-Soviet Union, 250 times more money than was moved by HSBC. Enough, in fact, to buy HSBC outright, with enough change to buy Danske Bank too. So how was this money moved? To understand this, we need to see how the transactions were structured. This was a Danish bank operating in Estonia, moving money from ex-Soviet republics, hiding its ownership behind British shell companies, which were in turn owned in the Marshall Islands, passing it on to banks in Germany and elsewhere. Every single one of those countries needs to cooperate if we're going to trace the money, and too often, they don't. It is hard enough for police officers to prosecute financial crime when all the evidence is in the UK. When they need evidence from half a dozen other countries too, the chances of a prosecution slip from small to negligible. The criminals know this and plan their crimes accordingly. It is bad enough that ordinary fraudsters are taking advantage of this, since fraud costs the average Brit £200 a year. The consequences of the kind of scam run by Danske Bank are more serious still. We don't know who all of that money belonged to, but we can be sure a lot of it belonged to the rulers of Russia, Azerbaijan and Ukraine, to some of the most egregious kleptocrats anywhere, perhaps even to Vladimir Putin himself. That means that, by transfusing this cash into our financial bloodstream, Danske Bank was giving someone who means us all harm the ability to buy almost anything he wants, undetected. In an age when small amounts of murky Russian cash have sown chaos in America, Austria, Italy and elsewhere, this is a national security emergency to be countered with utmost urgency. To counter it, we need a European version of the FBI, a transnational law enforcement agency to combat transnational crime. Criminals don't care about our borders, and we need to give police officers the ability to follow them wherever they go. This may seem far-fetched in the age of Brexit, Orban and Salvini, and it certainly won't be easy. But the role of murky money in funding all of these electoral campaigns just shows how urgent it is to investigate its origins, or else risk polluting our democracies forever.
Welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you for coming on.
200 billion, that's an insane amount of money. Can you tell us a bit more about that case? I can kind of see the undetected part. I can't imagine how it even arrives and leaves in the time span you're talking about.
Basically, the bankers in Tallinn working for Danske Bank created a system whereby they sold bank accounts with shell companies attached to them. So even they didn't really know who owned the bank accounts. And then ex-Soviet crooks just poured money through these bank accounts in incredible quantities, millions and millions and millions of dollars and euros pouring through these bank accounts. And once they were in Tallinn, they were in the Eurozone. And once they're in the Eurozone, they can go wherever they like. So it basically became like a breach in the wall of our financial defences. In films, there's always a little door in the castle wall that someone gets paid to leave open, and then the baddies go in there and then open the big gate. That's essentially what Danske Bank was. It was a little lich gate in the Great Wall around our financial system, and it allowed all of this money to come pouring in, and then the baddies can go and open the main gate. That's essentially what's happening. And it was, okay, over 8 years, but 200 billion euros. I mean, you could buy any company in Britain with that, I think possibly with the exception of Shell, but then Shell is kind of half Dutch anyway. So any actually British company, BP, sure, HSBC, sure, anything you like, you could buy that with 200 billion euros, have a lot of change. It's an incredible amount of money.
And how does the mechanics of that work?
What you need is essentially a way of taking your fingerprints off money. So the money belongs to you. You can tell it belongs to you, Vladimir Putin, or you, Viktor Yanukovych, or you, Ilham Aliyev, or whoever you are, whichever ex-Soviet ruler you are. You want to spend that on property in Knightsbridge or a yacht in Monaco or, you know, a villa in the south of France. But you don't want anyone to know it belongs to you. You want it to belong to a company which is registered wherever. So in order to achieve this, you just need someone who's willing to turn a blind eye and not ask questions of who really owns it. That was what Danske Bank's job was. Because once it's into the financial system, then it can just go bounce, 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 bounce. And with every step into every different jurisdiction, that means that there is a bureaucratic obstacle to figuring anything out. The more jurisdictions you need to get information from, the less likely you are to figure out who owns something. So if you imagine a property is bought in London and the National Crime Agency was suspicious of it, I mean, okay, we're already in far-fetched territory, but let's say they were, then they looked at it and said, I wonder who owns that. And they see, well, the money came from a bank account in France. And then they ask France, and then France looks at it and see the money came from a bank account in Germany, and they ask the Germans. The Germans then look and they ask Cyprus, Cyprus asks Malta, Malta asks Estonia. When they ask Estonia, Estonia asks Danske Bank, and Danske Bank doesn't know. So no one actually knows where the money came from. But in order just to get to the point of figuring out that no one knows where the money came from, you've already had to get cooperation from half a dozen different countries. And it's just too much trouble.
That means that in the criminal world, there's a whole layer of people who are intermediaries who look legal, but are actually the people behind shell company X, Y, in lots of different jurisdictions.
Yeah, I mean, this is a plug and play system. I mean, that's one of the things that's really interesting about all these scams is that whoever someone is, they always use the same intermediaries. There is a crime enabling structure for hire that just exists. You're a crook, you've stolen an absolute load of money, and you need to move it from an essentially inconvenient place like Russia to a convenient place like London. How do you get it there? Well, here's a system that will let you do that. And the whole system relies on the fact that they can move seamlessly between countries and money moves seamlessly between countries, but police can't. That's the great mismatch. You know, globalization is essentially incomplete, right? We have globalization for money, but we don't have globalization for law enforcement or for laws. And so what I'm arguing for is that within Europe, we need to essentially meet criminals on the same terrain that they're operating on. We need to say, well, they don't care about the borders between countries, so we shouldn't either.
Are we saying that all that money would have come from criminal activity, or would some of it have come from privatization, late stage state activity for which Russia is famous?
It's possible some of it wasn't criminal.
Why would you have to hide it?
Well, right. It is possible that if you are an honest businessman in Russia and you've made a lot of money, you don't want the government to know about it for kind of good reasons. But it's still criminal. This is the thing. It's like, even if you are dodging below the radar to get your money out so you don't have to pay tax to Putin, you're still a tax dodger. There is no good reason, essentially, to want to hide your ownership of vast wealth. It's just not a legitimate thing to do. So anyone who's doing it is inherently suspicious.
Do we have an idea that they're like estimates of how much criminal cash is circulating in the global financial system?
There is this figure which is used by the IMF and the World Bank, which is it's between 2 and 5% of global GDP. Of all the economic activity, between 2 and 5% of it is criminal. That was a guess by Michael Kamdassis, who ran the IMF back in the 90s. There's more scientific attempts to put a number on it since then. I mean, the estimates that maybe illicit financial flows are just over $1 trillion a year. So if it's $1 trillion a year, then Danske Bank is only a fraction of the problem. Just to put that into perspective, I mean, trillion, I think a lot of people struggle with numbers like a trillion and a billion and a million. You know, what's the difference between them all? Because they're all big. A trillion is a million times a million. So if it takes you 11 days to count to a million. It takes you more than 30,000 years to count to a trillion. It's a massive amount of money. And that much money is being stolen every single year. And if you're the kind of person who steals that much money, I think we can make other assumptions about you too. You are not in favour of democracy. You are not in favour of the rule of law. You are not in favour of open societies. You're not in favour of a free media. All of these things are threats to your ownership of your $1 trillion. Therefore, all of these things are essentially going to be campaigned against by the owners of this money, which is why we need to stop this money coming here in the first place, because it is a threat to everything that essentially the North London liberal elite, or whatever we heard about them at the Tory conference, you know, the good guys, everything that they hold dear.
For years, there have been rumors about Vladimir Putin's secret wealth, but a detailed picture of the hidden financial dealings of the Russian president remained elusive. The so-called Panama Papers may disclose an even bigger network than imagined.
I've always processed criminality as a kind of oligarch class in one place and a criminal class in another place, and those two places not having anything to do with each other. So even though clearly criminality is bad, the people you want to worry about are the oligarchs in terms of, you know, denaturing society and perverting democracy. But what you're saying is that it's possible now to be a criminal and also be an oligarch.
There's no line. It's not black and white. It's not like all of this behaviour over here on the black side of the graph is bad and the rest of it is fine. What you have is essentially always a sliding scale. You know, the difference between tax avoidance and tax evasion is just a criminal case. You know, one might be legal today and ruled illegal tomorrow. So you move into illicit activity and then you have tax avoidance, tax evasion, kleptocracy. They all of them use the same tricks and hide their money in exactly the same way, using the same people in the same jurisdictions. It is essentially kleptocracy, which is the dark side of globalization. Mm-hmm. It's just a function of globalization. So companies use it to minimize their tax burdens by moving their money via Bermuda and Ireland or whatever. Kleptocrats use it to minimize their exposure to criminal prosecution by moving their money through Estonia and Cyprus, or whatever. But the tricks are identical. They're just using it for different purposes.
Rich people can afford sophisticated accountants who can hide the money in offshore tax havens.
The Americans hit the streets of Georgetown in protest today, voicing their disdain that U.S. companies use Cayman banks as tax havens.
American companies get a free pass to write a check to a bank here in the Cayman Islands.
We're here to say, bring our money home.
Talked in the introduction about the difference between the analog and the digital age. Digital clearly makes this easier in lots of ways, but is there a more general problem of just light touch regulation, say Thatcher's changes in 1986, I think it was the Big Bang Revolution, this makes it much easier to move money. All of those package of changes that made it much easier to move money all over the world. I mean, that's part of this picture, isn't it?
To be honest, what Thatcher was doing was essentially recognising something that had already happened. Mm. You know, offshore had been invented for 30 years by then. There was this already an entirely deregulated space in London. She was essentially just saying, let's abolish the regulated bit and make everything the same as the deregulated bit. You know, the clever bankers invented offshore in the late 50s. But yes, so what you have is two things that are happening simultaneously. One is this essentially failure of regulation to keep pace with globalisation. This essentially surrender in the face of globalization, combined with certainly in London and more broadly other places, but certainly in London, a deliberate decision not to enforce the rules as a competitive strategy. So we, as a financial center in Britain, lost out heavily to Wall Street after the Second World War. And the way that we got that business back was by undercutting the Americans on enforcement. Just saying, you know what, there's this great line in a book called The Bankers, published in the 1970s, when a Bank of England official says, only half jokingly to the author of the book, you can do whatever you like in London, provided you don't do it in the street and frighten the horses. And he was only half joking. That was the point of London, is you could do whatever you liked. And so as long as you've got one place where there's no enforcement and no regulations, everyone else kind of has to catch up with you because all the business comes here. So you saw this in the Clinton years when they started removing regulations in the US. It was all to catch up with London because London was stealing all of their business. It was just saying we need to match what's happening in London. And then as soon as America undercuts us, we have to catch up with them. So it's a ratchet that always ticks in one direction.
And has that impacted Europe in the first place? Has the kind of role of London as this anything goes financial regulatory area meant that Europe hasn't built up the kind of legislative straight regulatory structures it would normally have done?
Essentially, yes, London is the major financial centre for the continent. You know, the big centre of euro clearing is here and so on. Inevitably impacts on anyone else's chance of getting started. You try and build a big financial centre in Paris or Frankfurt, you know, yeah, by all means, you go ahead, but good luck competing with London. Because it's not that bankers are inherently evil or whatever, I'm not saying that. It's just that people like being able to make money. And if it's easier to make money somewhere where there's no regulations, which of course it is, then that's where you're going to go. So it's just inevitable in the nature of the financial industry that where there are fewer checks on what the money's doing, the profits are higher.
So it sounds like if we're talking about how to kind of build Europe and kind of exercise its sinews as a potential block on this activity, we need to extinguish ourselves. That's our first move, to extinguish the UK.
That's not what I'm saying, because Europe has already moved ahead in this area quite well. I think we're now onto the fifth anti-money laundering directive, and these are, by global standards, far ahead of anything anywhere. They are very, very strong. We have now got not just transparency over the ownership of companies, but transparency now, not for the public, but for regulators over the beneficiaries of trusts. This is really important and way in advance of anything in America, though there is progress in America too. So this is a European level initiative. Right. You know, they're already trying to raise the level for the whole continent. There are places that are holding out. Malta, Cyprus, Latvia have been big problems for a long time in terms of not adhering to standards. But as a continent, there's a lot of effort being put into this, and it has been good. It's been very important. But that has gone without enforcement. You know, so that has been left to national level authorities to enforce. And if you have a eurozone where money is international, right, by its nature, if you've got one currency over a lot of countries, it's international money, but enforcement is national, you're in a ludicrous situation whereby the criminals can act internationally totally seamlessly, completely seamlessly, but the police can't. Mm-hmm. Which means that the police are outgunned always and all the time. It's not surprising that fraud is so enormous and taking off in incredible directions all the time in imaginative new ways every year. And when you've caught one crime, you know, just another one is invented. When it's that easy to evade scrutiny.
I suppose one thing that our listeners might be wondering when they hear it, particularly in the introduction, in a European FBI, is there a danger in focusing on treating the symptoms? So you've got all of this money flowing through the global financial system, it's dirty money, it's coming from criminal networks, and then you've got this problem and the solution is a European FBI, rather than addressing the structural problem that you also talk about, which is global financial liberalisation, the tax havens.
Yes, there are global structural issues that need to be dealt with, but it's a sort of slightly while I'm dreaming I'd like a pony situation. It's yes, there are major global issues that need to be dealt with, but there's just no way that Trump is going to be brought on board with this. It's just not going to happen. So I think you need to look at your own house and work out your own problems, solve your own problems, and then try and turn outwards. I mean, if you look at inequality statistics around the world, Europe is like an island, though things have got worse in Europe. Europe remains an island of relative equality in a sea of global inequality. And that must be protected. And one of the great reasons why global inequality has got so bad is because it is so easy for very rich people to keep their money and not have to pay their taxes they should be paying, or not to give back money that they've stolen, because it's so easy to hide money offshore. And so, you know, Europe needs to defend itself as a forepost of something better than that. And that's, to my mind, the very precious thing about Europe is the model of European society. All European countries are better in terms of equality figures than almost anywhere else in the world. And that is something that needs to be protected. And that can only be protected by the continent acting together.
I also think that the whole thing about calling it a kind of European FBI is it makes it sound quite sexy. And that's important, right? Because if you don't manage that...
You watch too much crime drama.
But it's true. If you don't manage that, the criminals sound much, much cooler than the regulatory structures and the institutions. I think the real knotty issue for our side, not for the kind of general UK citizen who might want to leave Europe, let's say, but for our side, there is a real problem making Europe sound both transformable and exciting. And I think it does make it sound quite exciting.
Yeah. What about your 5-step guide that you wrote in The Guardian, which was a great read that I will plug to listeners? But it was completely jaw-dropping. And one of the jaw-dropping things in this is that Vince Cable, on his watch, completely deregulated the company registrations. And as someone who has set up not-for-profit companies like Another Europe is Possible, this is deeply irritating to know that there are only some people that follow the rules and actually put in the correct information.
Beating up on Vince Cable is fun, obviously, as it's fun beating up on anyone. But, I mean, I genuinely think this was an accident rather than deliberate. I think it was an oversight and just a very, very unfortunate one. But essentially, it was always a problem with UK companies. It was just a bit more difficult to create them. There was always a problem with UK companies being used to commit fraud because they're legitimate-looking companies, and so you can use them in other countries and they look legitimate when they're not. But in the early years of the coalition government, when Vince Cable was business secretary, they essentially made it possible to log on to the Companies House website from anywhere in the world, create a company in 15 minutes for £13. And... the idea was to unleash the latent entrepreneurial spirit within the British people. The idea being, if it's easy to create a company, then if you've got a good idea for a business, then you'll create a company, you crack on, and we'll all get rich off the proceeds and the taxes you pay. But there was a tiny, tiny flaw in the argument, which is that if anyone can log on anywhere in the world and create a company for £13 without anyone checking any of the information they provide, then they will. So in that article you mentioned, I had a bit of fun just with silly names that people have given when registering companies. My favourite is Triple X Stalin. But there's another one whose name is YYYYYYY, whose address is, his residential address is You know, people just write nonsense. I mean, obviously ludicrous nonsense. You know, there are people who own companies who haven't yet been born. There's a Mrs. Natasha Brown who owned a company who was 3 months old when she created the company and not only found time to create a company in the first 3 months of her life, but also to get married. You know, it is... So Companies House doesn't have the statutory powers to check the information it's given to it. It operates like a library. And that is the excuse. If you accuse Companies House of essentially enabling a global fraud epidemic, which they have, because at Danske Bank, British companies with the biggest group of account holders, they, with the bigger binary options fraud, which was a sort of $10 billion a year fraud, that was British companies were used by the fraudsters in that. It's always British companies because they're so easy to use and so cheap. Companies House isn't really to blame because they don't have the powers to check the information provided to them. This is a political failure. And this was raised in Parliament. Annalise Dodds on the Shadow Treasury team, who's actually very good on this and seems to get this very well, she raised this a couple of years ago and said, why can't we check the information that's being given? And a Treasury minister, John Glenn, said, because it would be too expensive. He said it would cost a couple of £100 million a year to check the information. Personally, I think it's ludicrous. It would never cost anything like that much. But also, it's a really telling example of our priorities. We've got just binary options fraud, which is a global fraud epidemic, fortunately no longer existing, but when it was, a global fraud epidemic in which pensioners all over the world and anyone was losing their life savings to some really clever fraudsters, all of them operating behind British shell companies, $10 billion a year. And we weren't prepared to stop that for the cost of, even if it was a few £100 million a year. That is a $10 billion fraud, and we're not prepared to stop it for the expenditure of a few £100 million. You know, that's 1,000 times less to solve it than it is that it's costing us.
It feels, as you describe it, as though governments already slightly feel like it's not their job.
And this is what's so crazy, because it is, a shell company is crucial if you want to steal a lot of money. I mean, you can steal money by hand, you can pick someone's pocket, but you're talking about a handful of money. If you want to steal like a country full of money, you need a shell company. You can't do it otherwise. It's crucial. And so whoever is providing the shell companies shares responsibility for that. You are essentially the recipient of stolen goods. You are the mob banker in this context. Okay. And that is our job in this country. That is what we do. And the government has repeatedly failed to take that seriously.
So effectively you're saying Companies House, it thinks of itself as a library, but it's actually more like a fence.
Yeah, or a clever laundrette. Money goes in, it's washed, and it comes out the other side. If you look at the people who have used British companies to commit frauds, it's just an A to Z of global fraudsters. They're always British.
When you get to the point where the government can't be asked to spend the money to prevent the fraud, is it only in a kind of transnational context that anybody could sort that out?
Well, it's interesting because there's two answers to that. One is that despite everything that I've just said, Britain is actually a global leader on this issue. One of the reasons it's possible to find Mr. Triple X Stalin and all these people is that the British company registry is totally available and you can just search it online. It's all available for anyone from anywhere to look at. The American one, and America is the equivalent problem on the other side of the Atlantic, Even the FBI can't figure out who owns a company in Delaware, let alone an ordinary person. So one of the reasons we know Britain is such a problem is partly because Britain is so transparent. So there are other places that are problems too, but that isn't a reason not to solve the problem. And in fact, it's actually worse than that, because anyone who's a nerd like me and spends their time messing about on the Companies House website could find within minutes half a dozen problematic individuals that you can see are behind the really problematic companies. It's really easy to find them. You can trace to their companies. You can find what they're doing. The only person who has ever been prosecuted for creating a company with false information was a guy called Kevin Brewer, a businessman from Warwickshire, who created a company called John Vincent Cable Services Limited, specifically to show Vince Cable the problem that Vince Cable had created. And he then created another company when it was after the coalition ended and it was just the Tory government, called Cleverly Clogs Limited, in order to try and show James Cleverly the problem that was still going on. He specifically, deliberately created false companies, wrote to the government to show them what he'd done, said, look how easy it is to create these false companies. You are now a shareholder of a company. He was prosecuted and fined. I mean, he pleaded guilty because he was guilty and ended up just over £22,000 out of pocket because of the fact that he had broken the law. But he was essentially a whistleblower and he was acting as a whistleblower. He was prosecuted for that, despite the fact that he's an honest, honourable businessman and there are thousands of dishonest people doing this all the time who don't fess up and send the documents proving their crime to a Companies House. And that, I think, is actually a disgraceful episode, his prosecution, genuinely disgraceful. And that fact that, A, he hasn't been let off his fine, B, no one's apologised to him, and C, it hasn't led to any further prosecutions, is just a sign that no one's actually taking this seriously.
And there's another side to Britain's role in this, notwithstanding what you say about us depressingly being a global leader in it. But given how central the City of London is, it's a strong argument for keeping Britain in the EU to not let the City of London off the leash, because presumably all of the deregulatory Jacob Rees-Mogg style hyper-catastrophe capitalism stuff is like this on steroids in 10 or 15 years' time.
Yeah, I mean, I think we need to be careful when we talk about the City of London as if it's one thing. You know, the big banks, your HSBCs, your Barclays, they want to stay in the EU. They like the EU. So the city, per se, as a rule, is pro-EU. The problem is Mayfair. The problem is where the hedge funds are. Because as anyone who works for a hedge fund will tell you, if they're being honest, the way hedge funds make money is by cheating. That's their edge, is by cheating. And they always do that. That's what they do. The reason they can make good returns that banks can't make is because they cheat. And anyone whose business model is to cheat is threatened by regulation.
Is that right? When you say cheating, do you mean something other than betting on a socially negative outcome? Because that's how people perceive them, as people who want your currency to fail, who want this to happen, who want your shares to go down.
Well, no, I mean, it's more about you find ways to get inside information before anyone else has got it. You find ways to get a steer of what a company is going to be publishing. It's that stuff. That's where their edge is. Okay. Is they have the great intelligence, they have the corporate espionage stuff. And this is known, this is not a secret. Mm-hmm. The best performing hedge funds are the ones who get inside information before anyone else. And that business model is threatened by regulation. That's not the game that HSBC is in anymore. Since the big fine from the Department of Justice in the US, HSBC is not in the kind of moving suitcases of cash for the Sinaloa cartel anymore.
Okay.
Business. They don't do that.
So when you say the problem is Mayfair and the City of London is in favour of staying in the EU, I mean, and that is noticeable, right? I think there's a huge confusion around this in the media, certainly, that whenever anybody says the financial sector, they are taken to be people who are on the opposite side of productive businesses and therefore in favour of Brexit. But that's not right.
I mean, I would say in general, there's a distinction between productive and speculative capital.
Mm-hmm.
In general, anything that increases volatility is good news for speculative capital, right?
Okay.
Because that's where they make their money, when things go up and down. And so Brexit in and of itself is the biggest news-driven volatility event since the referendum. I mean, when we leave the EU, it's a brilliant opportunity for anyone who's into volatility to make an absolute load of cash.
Mm-hmm.
So that's one thing, which is one reason to like it. In a long term, another reason to like it is anything that reduces regulatory burden, anything that allows you to get away with more stuff, is profitable. So I think we need to be cautious, though, when we talk about the city as, or the financial sector as a whole. There are lots of different groups. You know, the big law firms, they like stability. That's what they want. They don't want crazy up and down seesawing stock markets every day.
There does seem to be a really strong relationship between corruption, finance, authoritarianism, and the new far right. Could you just spell out a bit more that relationship. I know there are examples of this in the book.
Corruption and kleptocracy I see as different things. Corruption is age old. There's always been corruption. As long as there's been authority, people have abused their authority. Kleptocracy is what happens when corruption plugs into a global financial system, because it means that you don't just steal money and bury it in a hole in the ground anymore. You steal money, put it offshore, and then spend it on yachts. It's a step change in the amount of money that can be stolen, because essentially any theft is a crime of opportunity. If you're going to get away with it, you'll do it. And kleptocracy and offshore finance makes it very, very easy to get away with it. So what you have is, since the 1960s, this very steep increase in the amount of assets kept offshore, this very steep increase in the amount of illicit financial flows, and a very steep increase in the amount of money that's being stolen. I mean, all the big kleptocrats, the real legendary ones, all began in the 1960s. You know, Marcos in the Philippines, Abacha in Nigeria, Pinochet in Chile. They all began 60s, 70s, you know, the real global mega crooks. And then it kicks off properly in the 90s with the Russians, and then 2000s with the Chinese. It's massive and growing all the time. And what is a threat to them? Well, a threat to them is the fact that another kleptocrat might come along in their country and take their money away from them. So they want to keep it somewhere else. And the place they want to keep it is a rule of law jurisdiction, because though they don't like laws when they're stealing the money, they sure as hell like laws when they're keeping the money. So having stolen it in Russia or Azerbaijan or Chile, they keep it in the United States or Switzerland or the UK. But once they've put it there, there's another threat to them, which is that maybe the law enforcement agencies in those countries are going to turn on them and take their money away. So they need to influence our political processes in order to make sure that they get to keep their money. And that is where the threat to us comes in. Leaving aside the moral qualms about taking stolen goods stolen from people who desperately need money and putting it into our own countries, the threat to our own democracy is the fact that these people really don't want our law enforcement agencies to enforce our anti-corruption laws and our anti-bribery laws, because that's a threat to them. So they like to influence our politics to make sure that doesn't happen. And this is one of the reasons that, certainly I think, the Russians have been trying to drive the far right all across Europe and the United States, is because the far right doesn't believe in international cooperation. It believes in all countries being to themselves, not cooperating with each other. And the solution to kleptocracy is international cooperation.
I find that depressing, because I always thought of Putin's agenda with pushing far right agendas across the as being a kind of demon of chaos, just because that's his worldview. But if he's just doing it to keep hold of a load of money...
Well, you've now got less respect for Putin.
I'm afraid so, yeah.
There's sort of, this is, you know...
It must have been quite a low bar.
In the Middle Ages, there was this doctrine, or the early modern period, this doctrine of the king's two bodies. You had the king as a person and the king as a kind of corporate entity. I think there's Putin's two bodies. There's Putin the person, who is this probably rather bored man sitting in his astonishingly luxurious residence, surrounded by his increasingly young female gymnasts. And then you've got Putin... the corporate entity, which is the group of people around him, which is some of the most successful thieves the world has ever known, people who went from being his judo partners to being multi-billionaires. These are very motivated thieves, very gifted thieves, and people who really don't want to have their money taken away from them. They keep their money offshore, they keep their children in Britain or in Switzerland, they keep their mistresses here, they keep their property here, they keep their yachts in Monaco and so on. So for them, what's happening in British or Monegasque or wherever law enforcement is a pressing domestic concern. They don't see the world in the way we see it, that Russia and Britain are different countries. They see the world in the way that Al Capone looked at Florida. Florida's where he kept his money. You know, he didn't see it as a different country. It's the same thing. Britain to Russian kleptocrats is like Florida to Al Capone, and it took the FBI to defeat Al Capone. That's why we need a European FBI to defeat the Russian kleptocrats, and not just the Russian kleptocrats, all the kleptocrats.
That concludes the podcast for those listening on the podcast platforms. The podcast is going from strength to strength, with more regular shows, more listeners, and great guests. But this all takes money and resources. That's why we've introduced extra time for paid-up members of Another Europe Is Possible. To join the campaign, just go to anothereurope.org/join. In this week's Extra Time, we'll ask Oliver where he stands on the argument that no deal is being pushed by hedge funds in order to satisfy their narrow economic agenda. Thanks to Oliver, and thanks to you for listening. To feedback to us on the podcast, you can contact us on podcast@anothereurope.org. We'd be grateful for ideas for new shows and content. You can also support the podcast by just telling someone about it. Go to your podcast platform and leave a rating or review.
Thanks for listening. We'll be back very soon. See you then.
So the big story this week has been that many of Boris Johnson's financial backers are the owners of these hedge funds, and they are deliberately pushing him towards no deal because somehow they stand to benefit hugely from the chaos that no deal would bring. There's been quite a lot of pushback on that idea, but on the basis that hedge funds bet on everything, you know, they hedge, that's what they do. But where do you stand? Do you think it could be as dark as that?
Yeah, I mean, I think we need to be careful not to delegitimize people's viewpoints. I mean, I think, you know, this idea that people only think something different to us because they're either stupid or crooked is a dangerous one with a long and inglorious history. So I think most hedge funds, you know, they hedge, it's what they do. They won't have a big exposed position. I mean, how do you short the pound in such a big way anyway? But it would be very, very weird if there wasn't possibly a small group of investors who see the chaos that would undoubtedly be unleashed by no deal as a really big earning opportunity. In a way, they'd be stupid if they didn't, because it is. The chaos that could ensue, if you're ahead of the game on that and you can figure out what would happen, then yeah, you could make an absolute fortune out of it. In the same way that, as we know, thanks to Cam Simpson's amazing investigation in Bloomberg, as we know that private polling helped hedge funds do on the day of the referendum itself.
Yeah.
You know, that's, if you're very clever and you've got a little bit ahead of the game, you could make a fortune.
There is a thing, I think, that anybody who makes money from volatility, for them to be hand in glove with any political figure, I find really dodgy, because you shouldn't, for your own nation, want it to be very volatile. But is that, am I being very dated?
I completely agree. I mean, I think this is, to be honest, goes hand in hand with the intellectual decline of the Tory party, that the Tory party would be so essentially bankrupt that they would take money from, I mean, let's be honest about it, you know, the spivs, right? In a wartime, you'd know what to call them. These are war profiteers. They're people who are essentially doing everyone else down in order to make money, because the money that they are earning from volatility is money they're earning from literally everyone else in the country. So I think this is more a sort of insight into the decline of modern conservatism and the lack of good ideas now in the Tory party, is the fact they're prepared to take this money. Because, you know, it wouldn't have been that long ago when you're taking money from JCB, and say what you like about JCB, but they do make stuff, and they make good stuff. Whereas if you're taking money from a hedge fund, they don't make anything apart from profits. It's an entirely zero-sum activity.
And the story originally came from a Bylines article, I think. So if listeners or members at this stage are interested in more, you could go and see the article on Bylines that sparked the debate. And from what I understand from the piece, they were basically, as a bit of investigative journalism into the hedge funds, as you say, who were backing Boris Johnson's leadership campaign, but they were taking a series of short positions on different companies. So there was like a kind of leap between Brexit and the economic fortunes of these companies. So, you know, they might well have had a short position on Thomas Cook that's just gone down, right, and made an absolute mint from it. But whether the death of Thomas Cook is to do with the economic volatility of Brexit, even though its managers might say it is, you know, there's a kind of indirect link there that some people pointed to.
It isn't possible to know what the position of a hedge fund is in real time, obviously. Otherwise, you know, they wouldn't be able to make a profit. So it isn't possible to say whether they are or are not speculating in the way that this theory suggests. But I know two journalists who I very much respect who are currently working on issues around this into electoral funding and also into the positioning of speculative funds at the moment. And they are convinced that in some form or another, there very much is a there. You know, this isn't, if not in the terms that the Byline Times said, that there is an aspect of shock doctrine, disaster capitalist-y stuff going on. And I find that very troubling. It was scary enough reading Naomi Klein about Poland and the former Soviet Union. It's pretty awful when it's Britain. You know, you would have thought as a country we would be institutionally robust enough to avoid that kind of behaviour. But the idea that one of our major political parties has been essentially financially captured by those kind of interests is seriously disturbing. And to be honest, if I were a Tory, which I'm not, and I don't think there's much of a prospect to me becoming one anytime soon, I would be really worried about this. Because who are you in bed with right now? It's not okay.
Well, thanks so much for coming on and talking to us.
Thanks
very
much.
It's been such a great chat.